You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Our subject tonight is baseball and the movies, and my guest is Richard Sandomir. Richard Sandomir, the author of a wonderful book about a classic sports film, both entitled Pride of the Yankees. Richard Sandomir, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
My pleasure, Gary.
Of course, your book has a subtitle, so I'm going to read that too. The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic. And oh, it really is a classic movie. What made you decide to write a book about it?
Well, doing the interviews I've done to promote the book, at first I was saying, well, I was attracted by the Gehrig speech, and then comparing it to the version that Gary Cooper gave. But then I realized that what inspired me most was reading a biography of Samuel Goldwyn by Scott Berg, and there's a half-page story in there that I recount in the book, where Samuel Goldwyn, being a Polish immigrant who knew nothing about sports and didn't want Pride of the Yankees to be a baseball movie, turned down the original suggestion by story editor Niven Bush that he make a movie about Gehrig. He said, baseball is box office poison. You want to go see baseball, go to a ballpark. And then Bush, who was a big sports fan from New York, he got hold of the newsreels of the day that Gehrig made the speech on July 4th, 1939. And he went to the screening room and he said, I'm just making up the dialogue here, but Sam, sit down and watch this. So the newsreel's probably about an hour, and there's, marching bands and speeches and gift-giving, and I could only imagine that Goldwyn was probably getting a little antsy until the end when Gehrig stepped up to make the speech. And by the end of the speech, and the lights go up, Goldwyn's crying. And he tells Bush to replay the newsreel. He watches it again. Lights go up, and he says, to somebody there, go get Mulvey, his number two guy, Jim Mulvey in New York. Let's make a deal with Eleanor. And that's what inspired me. I said, if I can build a story around that, because here's Goldwyn, who hated baseball, maybe didn't hate it, just didn't care about it. Here is Bush, who had interviewed Gehrig years before for The New Yorker and declared him in this story to be so boring, he didn't deserve to have a public. So, being a story editor and being a screenwriter himself, Bush obviously saw the story possibilities of Gehrig now having died of a tragic disease that people didn't understand and didn't even hear of, and finding a way to convince Goldwyn to make the movie. And when I went to the Samuel Goldwyn archive at the Motion Picture Library in Beverly Hills, there were this archive of envelope upon envelope of scripts and letters and correspondence and other documents that probably were responsible for 3/4 of the book. So that one passage in the Goldwyn biography is what starts me.
Yeah, and that's an excellent book. I read that book. And I loved it. The same could be said for me. I love baseball now. When I became an adult, I fell in love with it. But when I was a kid, I had absolutely no interest in baseball. But I loved movies. I was really, I always loved movies. And I loved that movie. And that was all I knew about baseball was The Pride of the Yankees.
Well, and, you didn't have to love baseball to love that movie. And that tells me that Goldwyn, in his ignorance, was very smart. He knew how to make movies. He knew how to please wide audiences. And there's only about 10 or 12 minutes of baseball action in the movie. Gary Cooper learned to play baseball as well as you could in 6 weeks when you're 40 years old. He never played it before. It didn't matter. Back in 1942, movie fans were not as demanding that their actors be good athletes if they're playing an athlete. It just didn't matter. Cooper was playing Cooper. It was just another role of quiet, dignified roles that Cooper played. And if it were entirely a baseball movie, it would have flopped. But it was a movie as Goldwyn dictated. a love story between Lou and Eleanor, and the story of a brave young man dying, you know, tragically before his time. So, you know, Goldwyn had that golden gut, and I think it really paid off in this.
When I first saw Pride of the Yankees, there was no internet or anything. Mm-hmm. And it was quite a few years later that I got a record of the golden age of radio or something. And I heard a recording for the first time of Lou Gehrig actually making his speech or what exists of it. And my first impression was, oh, Gary Cooper does it so much better.
Well, you know, Gehrig's voice was a very thick New York accent. He wasn't a trained speaker. And as I try to make the point in the book, Gehrig's image and his greatness is perpetuated by the movie and by Cooper's delivery of the speech. The speech has done by Gehrig doesn't exist in full anymore. The only intact speech is the one that Cooper delivered, which is somewhat different from the one that Gehrig delivered. But the greatness of the movie and the almost the purpose of the movie was to perpetuate Gehrig's image.
Well, I guess it wasn't uncommon for biopics, as they are called, to fictionalize lots of things, as long as they get the gist of the story or what's exciting about the person. I mean, I don't think there's too much fact in the Jolson story or some of those other movies that I love. And it doesn't matter. I think sometimes one of the problems with biopics nowadays is they try really hard to tell the whole story, and it gets kind of tiresome after a while.
Well, it's when they really veer off into absurdity, or they very clearly contradict the public record that is easily looked up now, that they fall into, they get into problems. When the Jackie Robinson movie 42 came out, there's a scene in there with a pitcher from Pittsburgh, I think, who beans Robinson. And the public record is very clear. He didn't do that. Others did. He didn't do that. And years ago in the 90s, when I was writing sports media for the New York Times, I did a story about a biopic of Rocky Marciano. And I noticed that in one of the sequences set in 1970, there's Marciano going to meet his idol Joe Louis in a sanitarium in Denver and handing him some money, because Joe had no money. Joe was in bad shape mentally. And Marciano was famously cheap, and he used to, the legend is that he'd pick up any dime and go through couch cushions to find change. So, and, you know, Marciano never liked the fact that when he fought Louis, he beat him to a pulp, because Louis was washed up at that point. And it's a very emotional scene, but it really couldn't have happened, because Marciano was dead in an airplane crash the year before. And when I spoke
that would
to
be
producer,
a problem.
When I spoke to the producer, I said, this scene is so inauthentic. He said, well, it could have happened. And I said, well, yeah, I guess conceivably, if it had happened when Marciano was still alive, but this is a dream sequence. These are the liberties that are taken in biopics, that some liberties are very broad, some are minor, you know, some are just involved in condensing characters and time. And like you say, you hope you get the essence right, and with Pride of the Yankees, Goldwyn got the essence right. And one of the things that fascinated me in the record that came out of the archive was how involved Eleanor was in vetting the scripts that came her way. She didn't get her way. She didn't change a lot of stuff that she objected to, but she would say things like, well, you know, there's a scene there where Miller Huggins, the Yankees manager, in a suit in the Yankee office, signs Gehrig to a contract. She said, you can't have that. That would be Ed Barrow, the Yankee president. Miller Huggins, the manager, would not be behind the desk in a suit. Or, well, you can have Lou's parents at our wedding, but they weren't there. And, but, you know, for dramatic purposes, in a way, the reconciliation that happens between Lou and his mother, the mother being kind of a fearsome, intransigent character, halfway through the movie, And then she softens, well, you couldn't have the parents boycott the wedding if this romance, this love story that's lionizing Lou Gehrig is to succeed. The mother has to come around. So it's forgivable. It contradicts the public record, but it's based on a true story.
based on a true story. Richard Sandemore, I learned in your book, The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic. I learned that Samuel Goldwyn wanted to. He said, "Can't you make it to two strikes and three balls? It's too long."
Yeah, I mean the ignorance was great, and he was surrounded. Even though Cooper didn't know anything about baseball, and Teresa Wright didn't know anything about baseball, and the cinematographer didn't know anything about baseball, he was surrounded by scriptwriters who did know. Paul Gallico was the sports editor and columnist for the Daily News. Herman Mankiewicz was a big sports fan and gambler. There were people, and Eleanor knew baseball. So, and Sam Wood, the director, was a former amateur ball player. So, when you needed baseball expertise, you got it. There's a picture in the book of taken in the scene where Cooper is now showing the ravages of ALS, and in spring training he can't really stand up to a pitcher, and he kind of falls backward into Bill Dickey's arms with a high hard one comes at him from the pitcher. And there's a picture where it's clear that Sam Wood, the director, is showing Cooper how to do this, because Cooper never saw a high hard one. He grew up in Montana, never played baseball. When he was between 8 and 11, he was in London, becoming a little gentleman with his brother, so in England. So he had to be taught, and Sam Wood was a very able and versatile director, also a communist hunter in Hollywood, a real right wing conservative who named names. But he may have been the right director for this movie, and whatever Goldwyn lacked in knowledge of baseball, he understood in how to produce a movie that would reach a female and family audience and sports fans. If nothing else, that was the reason to have Babe Ruth in the movie. Babe, who played himself pretty damn well, was the third star after Cooper and Teresa Wright.
He was actually better than William Bendix.
Oh, please. there may have been worse. Worst movies may have been made, but in 1948, when that was made, and for many years after, easily the worst movie ever, sports movie ever made. Bendix was completely ill-suited, and when you look at Babe's performance in some silent movies,
he had all that makeup on, and
I mean, he went in drag for one movie as the coach of a women's baseball team. He was. Unlike George Steinbrenner, who was fired by Larry David because he couldn't play himself, the Babe could play himself pretty well. Now, Eleanor didn't want him in the movie. Eleanor felt that he would steal scenes, that he would be a hog, and now she was looking after Gary Cooper playing her husband, that, for 10 years when they played together, Ruth overshadowed Gehrig and everybody else on the Yankees. She didn't want this to happen, so she said, "I don't want him there. At the very least, make sure he's never in a scene on as a solo scene." But I think she understood that Walter Brennan was not going to bring in sports fans if there's going to be any baseball verisimilitude. Babe Ruth provided. Now, Babe couldn't hit home runs like he used to. He was, 48 by now. But he could still swing like Babe Ruth. And in faraway shots, you could see the swing looked exactly like Babe Ruth because it was Babe Ruth swinging. It would take him a few takes to hit a ball over the fence, but he still looked like himself, and he lost 48 pounds to look like a chubby Babe Ruth.
And, I think it's one of the greatest things about the picture is that Babe Ruth is in it.
Yeah, and, when he bursts into the clubhouse eating hot dogs, and all the players are asking him, questions, was that your 30th home run, your 40th home run? I don't know, you count him, I'll hit him, you count him. He was... And I do regret not including one little anecdote in the book. I did say that because he lost so much weight, he had weakened himself, and he spent 2 weeks in a hospital with pneumonia. But there's a scene in the movie where the Yankees are celebrating winning the World Series in a train car, and at one point things got so rambunctious in there, you know, there may have been some actual real booze on the set. The Babe got really, really out of control, and he bashed his hand through a plate glass window in the train car, and he was in the hospital for a little while. But you know, back in the day, the studio seemed to have a camera, a photographer in hospitals, so you'd see pictures of him in his pneumonia jacket or getting stitched up by the doctor for his hand. I think he enjoyed it all. You remember, Babe was almost forgotten by then. He'd been out of baseball since 35, when he last played at 35. And, you know, nobody wanted him to manage. And he, you know, he was playing a lot of golf and drinking a lot of booze and eating a lot. And this is a chance for him to reunite with a few teammates and to be, if not the center of attention, you know, bask in Gary Cooper's spotlight. And I think he absolutely loved it.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game. With the crowd, buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back. Let me root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking tonight with Richard Sandomir. His new book is called The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic. It seems to me that after the making of The Pride of the Yankees, in which Babe Ruth played himself, that would have been the perfect time to make the Babe Ruth story with Babe Ruth playing himself, rather than wait and make that terrible movie with William Bendix.
It would have, and, you know, years ago I was doing an interview with the son of the director of the Babe Ruth story, a fellow named Thomas Del Ruth was the son. His father's name was Roy Del Ruth. And I said, I was talking to him about a movie about West Point that he directed. And I said, Tom, I got to ask you, you know, how bad did your father know the movie was going to be? And he said, well, the studio meddled a lot. And, you know, his original choice of Paul Douglas to play Babe Ruth was nixed. They wanted to build William Bendix. And he said it was rushed to the finish so that they could have a premiere with Babe Ruth there. And I think it premiered in, you know, middle of July of 48, and Babe died a month later. And, you know, you could reasonably say that the movie killed him. There's something in that movie that just sticks with me. Not just that it's so awful, but there's an early scene where the Babe hits a foul ball down a grounder in the foul territory that hits a dog, and Babe is so upset that he rushes the dog to the vet. And then the bookend to that scene is years later, the Babe is dying of cancer, and the doctor who treats him, the oncologist, is that same doctor who treated the dog. I mean, it sounds like a story that's narrated by Bill Stern, the old radio Falcon. And it's just like, okay, this movie, which had jumped the shark many times, just flew over the shark when I saw that towards the end of the movie. And Bendix just had so clearly had so few athletic skills. He made Gary Cooper look like Mike Trout. It was just for a character as vivid and fully formed as Babe Ruth to have had three movies about him and they all stink is really sad.
Yeah, they could have made a good one. Goldwyn should have jumped on it right then.
Well, yeah. Well, I think he was more than happy to be done with his only baseball movie that wasn't a baseball movie and just move on to other things that he understood. I mean, he understood all his movies. I don't think he understood Pride of the Yankees as much as he would have liked to.
One of the key sequences in Pride of the Yankees involves a little boy who's dying in the hospital. And Saturday Night Live had a great send-up of that. I'm dying, the little kid says, when he hears it on the radio.
Well, and also there's a Seinfeld parody of that where Kramer tells a little sick boy that Paul O'Neill will hit 2 home runs for him. And, it is probably the most contrived thing in the movie. And it really is the only baseball drama in the movie where, Babe and Lou go to a hospital and Babe promises a kid he'll not only hit a home run for him in this World Series game, but he'll hit it wherever the kid wants him to hit it in the stadium. And then, the Babe and all the camera people and reporters leave, and Lou sidles up to the kid shyly, and there's nobody covering this, and, the kid kind of convinces Lou to hit 2 home runs for him. And then it goes to the ballpark, and Bill Stern, the announcer I mentioned, who didn't like to stick to the facts of a situation, and on radio you can tell the people anything you wanted, and he's narrating this, and he's not really not describing a game, he's describing the competition between Lou and Babe to successfully keep their promises. What I found in my research was that this little kid who didn't seem to belong to anybody was variously in some scripts the son of a down in the luck guy, or he is the son of a very rich couple, the son of two people that Lou knew from his fraternity days, and there's a scene where the kid gets better and takes him to the house where this mansion where they live, and Lou is clearly feeling the ALS, and he can't even hit a ball tossed by a kid. And again, these were extreme. This is a kind of an extreme example that they really were never going to be able to show in the movie of the effect of the ALS. I mean, the only thing that you saw Cooper affected by was clutching his shoulder while he was play wrestling with his wife. And, very little else would indicate a little limp as he's walking off the field after he gives the speech. But, it's fascinating to see the development of characters. Even Mother Garrick went from being even harsher in her original conception, because that's the way Eleanor described her to Paul Gallico in their early interviews. And then she became not only accepting of Lou and Eleanor, but almost comic relief. Everybody changes in a script, especially when more than a few scriptwriters are dealing with. And I'm sure if I, looked at 5 or 10 scripts of almost any movie, you're going to see changes. But, I'm the only one who saw the changes in this one.
Well, so even though there was no little boy in the hospital, Gary Cooper is such a marvelous actor, and I think one of the great, great, great scenes in the picture is when the little boy is a grown boy and he comes to see Lou Gehrig at the end.
Yeah, that was written very late in the process. I believe it was suggested in a letter between Gallico and Goldwyn, where, meet the little kid, he's healed from his polio, and sort of, bring it full circle. What I found, which I didn't see in many of my initial viewings, and I've seen the movie 50, 60 times, is that as the teenage version of the little kid is finished talking with Lou and saying, look at me, I did what you said, I applied myself, I worked hard, and now I can walk, and clearly the teenage version of the little kid knows that Lou is suffering. As the teenage actor turns away, tears are flying off his face, and I didn't see that for a long time. And this was an actor who hated being an actor. He was put into the business by his parents, who just were not really good guardians. He ended up being a musician and a real estate guy, but he was a good actor, and he knew what to do. And it really has some of the most dramatic moments there. I mean, you could see, Cooper would act, his acting was in subtle kind of movements of his eyebrows and the corners of his mouth. And you could see that he almost, as the Garrick character, he almost didn't know what to say to the kid, you know, other than, do you have tickets for the game? And isn't that great? And, you know, you see there's almost like a passing of the torch, that he who was healthy is now ill and he who was sick is now healthy. And it was just, it's a beautiful moment that, to me, parallels Eleanor, Teresa Wright, watching Cooper as he's getting dressed for to go to the stadium to make a speech. And he no longer has the dexterity to tie his tie. And she's watching through, you know, from a distance, and she's tears are coming through down her eyes. And then she decides to cheer him up, and she makes believe she's a vendor, puts on a cap and fake mustache, and makes up a little megaphone. And the acting is so good in that scene. The smile on Cooper's face could melt an iceberg. You know, he knows he's ill. They each say to each other, you know, when, you know, we have time, we'll go to that honeymoon, we'll go to Niagara Falls. Yeah, we have our whole lives ahead of us, and they knew they didn't. At least he didn't, and they weren't going to have a life together. And, you know, Teresa Wright is about 18 years younger than Cooper, but you would not know that. They made a very... they created a kind of an equal couplehood. 22, 23 years old, she acted well ahead of her age. And she was a terrific actress. She, you know, first three movies, she gets an Academy Award nomination.
She really is terrific. And you know, I mean, that's what really makes it a great movie, is those two great actors.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, even though I felt that the Walter Brennan character was freighted with too many roles wrapped into one, advisor and a scout and newspaper man and, you know, matchmaker. Walter Brennan's a really good actor.
He also was a three-time Academy Award winner.
Three-time Academy Award. He made about seven or eight movies with Cooper. He's much better in Sergeant York, the fire-breathing preacher. It's a kind of a hokey movie all these years later, but... you know, it has great moments in it, and Brennan really has a much meatier part. You know, here it's as silly as, you know, Wright and Cooper are on the beach, and there's Brennan, you know, interrupting their reverie in, you know, in a suit and tie. And you know, but you know, this is, it's 1942. These are sort of the conventions. People ask me why I said nothing about the dance sequence at the, you know, during Lou and Eleanor's first date. And I said, I hate that scene so much. Much as I hate the opera singers who interrupt Marx Brothers movies, that I just couldn't bring myself to talk about Veloz and Yolanda, who they were contract players for Golden, one of them. And I guess you could say on the first date, taking her to a nightclub with dancers kind of makes sense, but it just, you know, they could have just moved from, cut that out and just have the singer at the, you know, at the with the big band there singing Always, which is their song. So I just couldn't bring myself to write about a dance thing.
If I'm not mistaken, it's the same director that put the opera singers, you know, in the middle of the Marx Brothers movie.
He did one or two.
But I do love Walter Brennan in that movie, and I love Walter Brennan in general. And I think one of the interesting themes of the movie, and I think that Walter Brennan does it as well as Gary Cooper and Teresa Wright, is this holding back of emotion. And that's kind of, you know, rather than revealing all, they are always holding everything back.
Yeah. I didn't think about that. I mean, I immediately leaped to Brennan, Sam Blake, not wanting to admit to Teresa Wright that Lou is ill and has to quit baseball. You know, in a way, in the movie, you know, Garrick had two wives, Sam Blake and Eleanor, because they were both so wedded to him. And but you know, that moment where Teresa Wright says to Blake, when's he going to die? And then, you know, Brendan has he's still trying to hold it in. He's still trying not to, you know, break down and, you know, admit that his friend is dying. And, you know, he's when he's hugging Eleanor, hugging Teresa Wright, it's like his eyes are like, he can't really focus. It's like he's shocked that she found out, but he shouldn't have been because she was obviously very perceptive. And, yeah, I mean, they're, but in holding back in a way, earlier in the movie, he's just being a guy's guy. Everybody's holding back. Except for Babe. Babe never held back anything. He didn't know how.
This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. We're talking tonight with Richard Sandomir. He's the author of The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and The Making of a Classic. Before we continue, let's go back to July 4th, 1939, Yankee Stadium, and hear the real Lou Gehrig making his famous farewell speech.
First baseman Lou Gehrig hung up an amazing mark by playing in 2,130 consecutive games. Then a fatal disease attacked baseball's Iron Man. In Yankee Stadium, touched to tears by the tribute, Gehrig made his last public appearance.
For the past 2 weeks, you've been reading about a bad break. Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. When you look around, wouldn't you consider it a privilege to associate yourself with such a fine-looking man as is standing in uniform in this ballpark today?
That I might have been given a bad break, but I've got an awful lot to live for. Thank you.
That was Lou Gehrig, recorded at Yankee Stadium in 1939. Now, let's hear Gary Cooper from the movie Pride of the Yankees.
I have been walking on ball fields for 16 years. And I've never received anything, kindness, and encouragement from you fans. I have had the great honor to have played with these great veteran ball players on my left, Murderer's Row, our championship team of 1927. I have had the further honor of living with and playing with these men on my right. The Bronx Bombers, the Yankees of today. I have been given fame, an undeserved praised by the boys up there behind the wire in the press box.
My friends, the sports writer.
I have worked under the two greatest managers of all time, Miller Huggins and Joe McCarthy. I have a mother and father who fought to give me health
and a solid background in my youth.
I have a wife, a companion for life,
who has shown me more courage than I ever knew.
People all say that I've had a bad break. But today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
Gary Cooper playing Lou Gehrig in the film The Pride of the Yankees, and we're talking tonight with Richard Sandomir. He's the author of The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic. This book, Richard Sandomir, you follow several threads. So you have this, the true story of Lou Gehrig's demise. You have the making of the film, the reaction to the film, the legacy of the film. How did you get it all organized? What was your plan?
I am not very organized. There was going to be another thread of, you know, at least one or two chapters on the influence of the movie on sports movies going forward, and I really cut that out. I just didn't think that was relevant. You know, you kind of knew that you had to do a mini biography of Lou. Very little about the early years. I had to tell the story of his death and his funeral, and you know, my research just showed also that, you know, within 2 weeks of him dying, the wheels are moving to start make a movie about it. And, you know, Eleanor barely had time to sit Shiva, and she's, you know, getting calls from David Selznick and MGM and Goldwyn. And she, you know, I don't think until after the movie was made that she really had time to mourn. And maybe then she mourned for the rest of her life. And, you know, one thing that I really wanted to do once I got hold of all the archival materials is that because there was such an evolution of characters and story and so many good letters, especially between Eleanor and her agent, Christy Walsh, that I wanted to tell the parallel story of the story of the movie itself. If people didn't, you know, people were not familiar with the movie or all they could remember was the speech, I wanted to tell the story of the movie and then pull back and in relevant moments say, okay, here's how we got here. And then I see in the archival files that Eleanor was sitting in the soundstage while they doing some of the filming of the speech. And oh my God, I gotta have that. And that's part of her agreement. She's allowed to see rough cuts, and she didn't see everything that she was probably entitled to see, but she's sitting there while an actor playing her husband is giving the speech, which is pretty amazing.
That must have been difficult for her.
And well, she was crying, so she had to leave. She didn't see the final, you know, however many takes it was. So it was. So the files were just gave me so much, and I knew from very early in my research that there had to be multiple epilogues, especially two things involving Cooper, that a year and a half after the film is locked down, he's doing a USO tour in the South Pacific, and at when they stop at Port Moresby, after he and the rest of the USO troupe have done their comedy routine, they sung Pistol Pack and Mama, and Cooper did some of his friend Jack Benny's routines. One soldier shout out, hey, Coop, how about that, the Gehrig speech from Pride of the Yankees, which they'd apparently seen at some point beforehand. And he said, well, give me a few minutes, I got to write it down, I didn't memorize it. And whatever version he delivered was delivered to the silence of hundreds, thousands of soldiers who, you know, for all they know, they meet a tragic ending the next day. And at each stop, for the rest of the trip, ending in Sydney, he delivered the speech. And then, one day while I'm doing my research in Beverly Hills, there's one day where the library's not open, so I'm sitting in my hotel room, and I'm Googling around on my laptop. And I see that there was a Friars roast for Cooper in 1961, January 61. Well, I knew he died that year. He died in May. And there's a recording of the entire roast just sitting there. Somebody had digitized a 45 record of the roast. So you get, you know, a lot of people old, of modern Hollywood at the time, but it's old Hollywood by now. Milton Berle, Georgie Jessel, Audrey Hepburn, Greer Garson, Tony Martin, Dean Martin, Jack Warner, Sam Goldman. They're all making speeches. And Carl Sandburg is there. And a lot of the roast material makes fun of how terse cowboy Gary Cooper was, you know, always saying yep. And then I'm listening to it, and Cooper gets up, and I didn't know at the time that Billy Wilder wrote the speech for him. He gets up, and he says towards the end, and it's a very, you know, respectful, grateful speech. At the end, he says, well, if any of you out there, you know, don't believe I'm... It was something like... He was paraphrasing the Luckiest Man speech, where he says, I'm, you know, I believe I'm the luckiest, you know, I'm the luckiest man in the world, and if everybody, you know, and I believe that, yep. I'm just paraphrasing. I can tell it better. So, you know, he combined both the influence of Pride of the Yankees and his cowboy image. And I'm looking at that, and I immediately, like, I call up Cooper's daughter, and who is really the only person from, you know, I could speak to about her father. And she's, at the time, she was 77, 78. And I said, do you know about this? And she said, I was there, sitting in the hotel ballroom watching this.
Wow.
And so, and it turns out that much like Eleanor did not allow the doctors to tell Lou that he was dying when he was diagnosed, and for all we know, she never told him, there was a lag in time, there's a delay before Cooper's wife, Rocky, told Coop that he was dying. Now, he'd had, you know, operation for his cancer, but she didn't tell him now that it was incurable. So, you know, I said, Maria, you just gave me a chapter here. She said, well, you call me for help, don't you? And it, you know, it was, and then, you know, there are other little strands of, you know, epilogue material. Teresa Wright, when she turns 80, becomes a rabid Yankee fan.
That's incredible. I love that story.
Oh, I mean, it's just so sweet. You know, here's the Yankee PR guy, Rick Cerrone, not the Yankee player Rick Cerrone, but the Yankee PR guy. He's watching the Oscars that March, 1989, and, you know, he's looking out at, they have a presentation at an Oscar winner from every year that the Academy has been around is sitting on the stage. And they get to Teresa Wright, and he said, I love Pride of the Yankees. And so he invites her to come to the stadium for the anniversary of the speech, and she gets a big ovation when they show that she's in the stands, and they show a clip from the movie. And, you know, she suddenly gets seduced by baseball and Joe Torre and Derek Jeter.
Baseball fever.
So, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, one thing just kept leading to another. And after a while, I joked that I'm not organized. I'm really not. But it kind of organized itself, and it was just, it really was a joy to do this, because there was such a wealth of material, not only from, you know, the Goldman Archive, but from the Baseball Hall of Fame, where Eleanor left her papers, at least her baseball-related papers. And every time I looked at something, I'd see, holy cow, look at this letter from Christy Walsh. He's talking about how Babe and his wife aren't sleeping in the same room in the hotel while he's shooting the film, because, you know, he's like a henpecked, typical henpecked husband. She won't let him, you know, go out with the boys. He wants to go out with John Barrymore. Come on. And it was just captivating. And, you know, I'm just so glad that I did it, and so happy I turned up so much information that I knew if it surprised me, it would surprise other people.
Well, I'm very glad that you did it as well, because I enjoyed this book so much, and it really is, you know, the film deserved a great book, and you delivered.
Well, thank you.
The book is called The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic. And the author, my guest, Richard Sandomir. Thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
My pleasure, Gary.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Richard Sandomir. He's the author of The Pride of the Yankees, Lou Gehrig, Gary Cooper, and the Making of a Classic. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we'll see you next time.